And we are approaching the end of Ramadan, the holy month where Muslims fast from dawn to sunset. The fact that hundreds of millions of people around the world go without food all day has drawn the attention of another group of people, social scientists. To learn what they discovered, our David Greene sat down with NPR social science correspondent, Shankar Vedantam.
Okay, Shankar, so explain to us exactly what social scientists were studying here.
Well, David, these are researchers who are trying to tease apart the effects of religious faith and behavior on economic activity. I spoke with Felipe Campante. He studies public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School. Here he is.
Being in church or going to the temple means that at that time you're not going to be working or you're not going to be engaging in materially productive activities.
Campante told me that there's a chicken and egg problem. It's hard to know whether religion is actually changing economic activity. So, for example, if we see more religion in poorer parts of the world, which we often do, is that because religion has shaped economic life, or is it because being poor is a driver for pursuing religious beliefs?
Interesting. Actually causing people to look for religion
exactly,
to improve their lives. Well,
mm-hmm.
Let's talk about how Ramadan fits into all of this. Is there some connection here that we're talking about?
Yeah. So Campante told me that Ramadan offered him and his co-author, this is David Yanagizawa-Drott, a unique way to solve this chicken and egg riddle. And that's because Ramadan happens to be a religious observance that falls at different times of the year. It's driven by the lunar calendar. So some years you have Ramadan in the summer, some years you have it in the winter. When Ramadan falls in the summer, as it does this year in the United States, the days are longer. Now, since Muslims who observe Ramadan are supposed to fast from dawn until sunset, what this means is that the length of fasting will depend on the season. Campante and Yanagizawa-Drott analyzed changes in the lengths of fasting in 167 countries over more than 60 years, and they measured how economic productivity rose and fell in those countries over that time. And they found that longer periods of fasting were associated with a drop in productivity. So having your fasting go from 12 hours a day to 13 hours a day, for example, means a GDP drop of about 0.7%, which is quite sizable. And interestingly, they find that this effect is only in Muslim-majority countries, so they're not picking up on some seasonal variation in economic productivity.
And seasonal variation, I mean, that might have been the challenge if we were talking about a different holiday, like Christmas, like Hanukkah, that falls around the same time every year. There could have been other factors at play.
Exactly.
Well, okay, then, the conclusion that these researchers seem to be heading towards, Shankar, is that religion is bad for your country if it impedes economic growth, not something that a lot of people really want to hear, probably.
Well, I think the story might be more complicated than that. Campante finds that the changes in economic activity are not driven just by what happens during Ramadan, but broader changes in attitude. So Muslims who are observant seem to place greater focus on family, greater focus on social well-being rather than individual well-being. And there's survey data from more than 200,000 people in dozens of countries that produces a finding that your standard economist might not like. Here's Campante again.
Muslim individuals become more likely to report that they're happy and that they're satisfied with their lives. So in that sense, the practice of Ramadan may make people poorer as a result of the slowdown in economic activity and the way they sort of choose to change their economic behavior. But on the other hand, it seems that they are happier.
Material versus non-material satisfaction, right?
Yeah, and I think that's the point that Campante is making, which is he's saying that policymakers might not want to use economic productivity as the sole measure of success. As he puts it, GDP is not everything.
Shankar, thanks as always.
Thanks, David.
That's Shankar Vedantam, who regularly joins us to talk about social science research. You can follow him if you're on Twitter, at Hidden Brain, and you can also follow this program at NPR Green, at NPR Inskeep, and the show is at Morning Edition.
The essential act of doing laundry is a chore many of us dread. A lot of busy people outsource it if they can. But for the working poor, the $20 to $40 a week cost and time involved hauling clothes to the laundromat can be daunting. From member station KCRW in Santa Monica, Lisa Napoli introduces us to a growing movement to relieve some of the burden.
It's 7 o'clock on a weeknight at a coin-operated laundromat in a strip mall in Huntington Beach, California, 40 miles south of Los Angeles.
All right, guys, welcome out. Thanks again for coming. We can't do this without you. Laundry
People have been lined up outside for several hours now, waiting for the chance to do their wash for free.
Help us not to cling so much to it and pass it on. Amen.
After orientation and a brief prayer, volunteers direct the first in line inside to the machines, and the washing begins. Giovanna Cortez has three kids and loads of dirty laundry to prove it. She lost her job in March.
I have to come because I have no money for laundry.
So how much money do you save?
I probably saved last month like $50. You save on soap too, so it's $50 plus, so yeah.
The free wash and supplies are provided courtesy of a ministry called Laundry Love. A dozen years ago, an Episcopal congregation in Ventura, California, came up with the idea. Now, more than 70 churches, mosques, and synagogues around the country practice Laundry Love. Here in Huntington Beach, a group of people disillusioned with traditional church started taking over this laundromat once a month. They raised the $500 to pay for quarters, detergent, and dryer sheets. Shannon Kassoff is one of the organizers. This is your church now.
This is our church. This is absolutely our church. It is probably the best way to be involved in other people's lives, not just handing out food in a soup kitchen or whatever. We get to know them very well, and that's probably the best part of this whole deal.
Everyone mingles together like a giant spin cycle. It's hard to tell who's here to wash and who's here to assist.
Wait a minute while I add my bleach here. Oh, the bleach light is on.
David Clark never imagined he'd be on the receiving side of a charity. He lost his job as an aerospace machinist several years ago and now gets by, barely, working part-time at a grocery store. Laundry Love has become his big night out.
Gives me the time to come and socialize with some nice, upbeat people and feel a little bit better about myself.
Do you know how much money you'll save tonight or each time you come?
Yeah, I would say about $15 probably. That's a lot these days.
Helping people has become a spiritual practice for volunteers like Ken Kawamura.
You know, I just like serving. Really, that's all it is. I try to find things where people are ignored, or also situations that people don't want to engage or, quote-unquote, get their hands dirty. Some of these people, they come here once a month, and they probably do their laundry once a month. Like right here, we have a couple. We have 18 loads.
Practicing the biblical commandment to serve your neighbor can seem daunting at times, says volunteer Shannon Kassoff, until you see the laundromat in action.
This is probably the most meaningful thing that we do because we're taking our love outside of the walls of church and bringing it to the people and sharing what we think is an amazing experience, and that's just love. Yeah.
One laundry load at a time. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Napoli.